So this talk is growth. It's a good problem to have, but what are you going to do about it? So this is, I see we have some end users here, but this is targeted towards partners and how they deal with their customers more than what you do with the growth problems at your own shop. So if you'd like to be somewhere else, this would be a good time to go. Might be entertaining anyway. You know, if you hit this little button here, the screen goes off. So, who am I? I'm obviously not part of Kim's team. I'm a... Hello.
He wants a surface.
No, I don't want a surface. I've been using Progress for a long time, since 1987. I think you were all born then, but that's not always true. And I have a couple of different hats I wear. I wear the beanie. I'm also vice president of White Star Software, which is a kind of a traditional consulting firm where we do time and materials, hourly billing kinds of things for people. We are mostly focused on database issues, but we also do a little bit of application consulting as well. I'm also the president of DB Appraise, which is a remote monitoring and management kind of a subscription service. They're really the same company, same people and all that kind of stuff. Well, I shouldn't say really the same company because lawyers wouldn't like that, but they're related. What we do is we try to simplify the whole management, monitoring, alerting kind of process for people so that they don't have to develop expertise in that area. So that's me. A little bit more. Once upon a time, way back in 1987, I was an application partner. I had a small company that built the Progress application. We started kind of small. We had a lot of success. We grew very rapidly. Dimitri knows about this. We got to selling to a lot of really big customers, and that turned out to be interesting. And we learned a lot of lessons along the way. I sold that company 20 years ago and have been in this consulting sort of a role since then. But it's interesting because I've seen both sides of the partner equation, and there are some very interesting lessons that I hope you'll find them as interesting as I find them. So, now we need to know about you. Now, this is a really big audience. So how many of you are partners of one form or another, Progress partners? All right, got one. and I see a lot of you people are people from Kim's organization, so that's good. Some direct end users. Do you have a partner that you're happy with? Yes, no, maybe? Okay, cool. Thinking about becoming a partner. Hey, all right. I think you should have been in the last session because that was a services partners talk, so that would have been a good one for you to sit in on. Oh, well, there's cool stuff. We'll talk about that later, afterwards. How long have you guys been working with Progress? Anybody here been working with Progress longer than me? No. 20 years. All right. 10. Two. Okay.
Beat me by 2 years.
Are we mostly technical people or business people? I think we're mostly technical is what I'm seeing.
Business.
All right. Jack of all trades kind of business?
Yes.
Okay. So technical people, how many of you are pretty involved with figuring out how to run your company as well? Yeah, that's typical partner kind of thing. Let's see, number of customers that, well, Mike, how many customers you got? If you don't mind saying, roughly, ballpark. Less than 100? More than 100?
Would have said around.
Around 100? Are they mostly small, mostly big, nice mix?
Well, we're providing service to Progress developers from
single developer, single person companies to one of the biggest partners in Europe.
So you got quite a range, quite a spread of situations that you're looking at. So yeah, we don't really, you know, you tell us your sales volume, but I suppose you really want to. So that's pretty cool. So success. Most of us, I think, have been successful. That's part of why we're here. We have built an application, or we're providing some services that people are attracted to. And it usually, with a progress partner, it starts out, somebody had a business idea. They had a problem they wanted to solve. They conceptualized that. They got it turned into some software. And people liked it. They started buying it. You know, you go out there in the marketplace, you sell it, whether it's services or whether it's a product, whatever it is. And now you have this situation where the sales have taken off. You know, you're happy, things are going well. What's next? Well, you can draw pretty lines for your CFO. CFOs like that kind of thing. It's a nice Excel spreadsheet. But, whoops, wrong way. Oh yeah, okay. Sales take off, and the issue becomes that some of the customers become very successful. Or you attract attention from really large customers. So you either have a typical ideal kind of a customer who might be a certain size, and then somebody really big comes along and says, I want that application. And they're way out of scope of what you're used to. Or maybe you are that customer. Or you just have so many sales that you don't know how to handle it. So that's part of what we're going to talk about. That's like having a tiger by the tail. You know, have you ever had a tiger walk by your cube and grab it by the tail? Got any idea what would happen if you did that? Those cube walls wouldn't be standing very long.
I don't think you would be.
So there are a lot of headaches when you have too much of a good thing. Which is really what this is all about, too much of a good thing. Sort of like that beer last night. Although Mike tells me that was not enough of a good thing. So some of the problems, some of the headaches that you have when you have these too much success are you have trouble keeping up with demand. You have a lot of implementations going on. Where do you get the people to actually go out and deploy your system? And that can lead to a lot of unhappiness in your customer base. Or if it's the case that you have acquired a really big customer and they're outside of your experience level, then you probably don't really understand how to deal with their requirements, their needs, what it is that makes them different from your smaller customers. Finding technical resources to build out new features, enhancements, and customizations. So you have a lot of demand, or you have a really big customer, suddenly you've got to hire people to build customizations, to support them, to do the things that are new and that are different because of this situation that you're in. And then one that's near and dear to my heart is deploying scalable systems. So a lot of, we back up a couple of slides to somebody had a really good idea, they turned it into an application, but you know, when they were doing that, they weren't really thinking about issues of scalability. They were thinking about functionality. It probably wasn't a DBA that created that system. It was probably some business guy working with a napkin and might have had a college kid working for him or something. Sounds familiar to me anyway. So you end up with this situation with implementation demand, for instance, where you know, the peasants are storming the castle trying to get stuff out of you. Kind of scary thing. So what can you do about that? Well, Progress has some solutions for you, some product or technical sorts of solutions. You can go down the SaaS route where you move your application into the cloud, where it's a little bit easier to deploy, where you have more flexibility in terms of the architecture. And the other nice thing about it is that it takes a lot of the burden of doing a deployment away from waiting for the customer to provision systems and whatnot into your own staff, where you control it, where you control the process, and things can be a little smoother there. Yes. Multi-tenant databases can help you by consolidating a lot of different configuration into smaller number of physical units and resources, so you don't have quite the resource demand, particularly if you're in a SaaS kind of environment. Or you can get into the Progress Services Partner ecosystem. So you basically start working with partners. Now, all the good ones are down in the expo. So, you know, afterwards, make sure you go down to the expo and talk to the services partners. We have lots of them. But there are others. I don't know how to find them, though, because they're not here. And then some of the other things that come up when you have implementation demand are you need to have a customization management strategy, because one of the big things that happens is you have a lot of customizations to deal with. How do you manage that? That's another one of those things that you probably weren't thinking about very much when you first designed the application, because the application was perfect, right? That's how you designed it. And one of the things that can really help a lot, yes, Mike?
Or you may experience, I've experienced a couple of customers that when a new project started, you paint it as a very important thing on top of the requirements.
Yes.
And then you suddenly realize that, well, you run out of time and double line the customization management strategy was the thing which usually falls behind.
Right after testing, or just before testing. Yeah, customization management becomes key because it's at the root of a lot of the deployment and implementation headaches you have. Everybody wants customizations, and if you haven't thought through how you're going to support them, you get this big mess. And then utilization of a rules engine is something that people don't tend to think about early on, but it can help you to solve a lot of these problems, a lot of issues. I'll talk about that some more. So. Don't worry, that's not just a one-off. So, some things that can help you with customizations in terms of strategy. Try to be data-driven. Do your customizations using as much data-driven sorts of structures as you can, rather than code. If you have to deploy different versions of code to different customer bases, you're going to very quickly lose track of that code, unless you have something great like Roundtable to help you out. Or you'll run into situations where you deploy something to somebody, it's a customization, and but you know you're testing it, you're not done with it yet, and then somebody messes around with something and overwrites it, and how it's gone, and stuff like that. Code is much harder to deal with than data. It's much easier if you can go into a screen somewhere, configure something, you have a little repository of the way you want the behaviors to happen, and then the code is the same for everybody, it just branches depending on what the data is. And code's a lot more brittle. Over time, it just grows and grows and grows. You get this nested, if this, then run that kind of stuff going on, and 20 years down the road, you forget why you wrote it that way, and nobody can untangle it anymore. You guys might know a thing or two about that. But one thing you don't want to do, I say to be data-driven, but one thing that is really not a good idea, that sometimes people go too far the other direction, and they build a database inside a database, where all of your data elements are key-value pairs in a couple of tables, and you got to go through two or three layers of indirection before you can actually find anything. That's horrible. It makes great demo. But you know about making great demos. That's not really how you want to deploy things. I was recently out on the road doing a little evaluation for somebody, and that system had one of these create any custom field you want sort of features, which was a key value pair thing. They had 5,000 custom fields for their application, completely unnormalized. Stuff like customers had it was a lending system. So you had loans and borrowers, and borrower one first name, borrower two first name, borrower three first name, totally unnormalized. So you have 5,000 fields for this application. And they're trying to figure out how they can migrate it. I don't know why they would want to migrate it.
Keep a stack of 3x5 terms.
Not bad, good plan. So don't do that. Don't build the database inside a database. It's very tempting sometimes, but it'll end up being a performance and understandability nightmare. Rules engines. It's hard to say enough good things about rules engines because rules engines solve so many problems for an application. I'm going to try though. I can give you a few reasons. So one of the things it does is it helps to clearly separate the logic from the UI. One of the things we've been hearing architecturally for the last 25 years has been, well, you got to separate your application into layers. You need to have a data access layer, you need to have a UI layer, you need to have a business logic layer. Rules engines are a business logic layer, and they are very powerful, and they help you to clearly separate that business logic from the rest of the code. A lot of application partners, Progress application partners, have built rules engines over the years, and they're some of the most powerful and useful features of their applications. Another thing that they do are they make it so that you can test the business logic without the UI. So it makes it more testable. You're able to write a test harness that can test all those rules without having to drive the UI, without having to write special customized programs for each one of those bits of logic and all that kind of stuff. They allow you to put the customization burden out of the hands of the coders and into maybe somewhat technical, but business people. So business analysts or somebody like that can often do an awful lot of the rules engine work. And what's really great about that is that because it's data and because it doesn't have to go through the IT code creation and testing process, is you can often turn around the customizations a lot faster. And it moves the logic out to the customer rather than you. So you deliver the generic functionality. The customer who wants the customizations then says, well, I'm going to add these rules, I'm going to modify this here, and you have a nice record of what was done, and it's their responsibility, not yours. Pretty powerful stuff. Which makes everybody really happy. Everybody's happy when they have rules. Progress just happens to have an awesome rules engine. It's called a Corticon. It's a declarative kind of a rules engine, so it's almost like writing if-then-else statements. It's a very spreadsheet-like UI. I'm a big fan of it. Kim didn't make me put this slide in here, by the way.
So they didn't have to pay money for this slide?
Nope, they didn't have to pay for this slide. Corticon is not dependent on the Progress version. There are some integrations, some much stronger integration with Corticon, starting with 11.3. I think it's 11.3. Might go back to 2, but so you can do a more direct call to Corticon, whereas prior to that you had to do web services kinds of things. But what's really nice, unlike a lot of the vendor-provided rules engines that are built into applications, is the spreadsheet UI and the tools that are around it are much, much more usable. They have a lot more thought about the rules engine part of things than you see from something that's homegrown. And it can do design time, conflict, and coverage analysis. This is really good. So if you write two rules that don't agree with each other about how the fields or the values are supposed to work, it'll find that for you, and it'll tell you about it right up front. It'll also tell you if you've missed things. So if you are trying to write a rule which covers all of the data values that you have in a certain field, or a combination of fields, and you forget some of them, Corticon can tell you about that. You can say, hey, wait a minute, you forgot about. It'll go and it'll consolidate the rules and optimize them. So from a purely how many rules do I need kind of thing, if you've got X number of fields and you've got all these conditions, it can get very large very quickly. So you have tens of thousands of rules required to go through a kind of a scenario. The rules engine can look at that and can consolidate them down, and so you end up with only half a dozen or something like that. It's really very amazing how well it does that. It's very scalable. It scales linearly, whereas the competing products, the big names in the industry, the iLogs and whatnot, scale very badly. The more data you feed them, the slower they get. Corticon just goes straight. You can deploy it on either .NET or Java. So Windows or Unix, you're not tied to either one of those platforms. You can have your pick. Of course, in case anybody's curious, Unix is better. And you can cluster the rules engine. And something that people do not seem to know is that Progress dropped the pricing on Corticon radically about 6 months ago. It used to be, am I recording this? It used to be $80,000 a core, so nobody would buy it. It's now 100 and something per user. So it's much, much more affordable than it was a year ago. And so if you've been holding back on Corticon because you think it's too expensive, you should revisit that discussion.
It's how much per user?
It's 100 and something. It's 120, 130, something like that.
Sorry.
Well, that's a starting point for negotiations, and it's way better than 80,000 per core. Trust me, they negotiate. So if you have Corticon and a rules engine and stuff like that, you're in programmer nirvana. No, he's smiling. This is a good thing. He's got a cup of coffee. Come on, this is a happy programmer. He's got a coffee full of bits. A coffee full of bits.
He looks like being an Irish coffee.
Okay, so one of the other big headaches you have in your life as a partner that's experiencing growth is this whole issue with big companies. Anybody here work for a big company?
No.
No, you don't. You two, on the other hand. So I'm going to say some bad things about big companies.
That's
please
okay.
Don't pay any
we
attention.
Might agree.
Big companies can be interested in some things that your smaller customers probably are less interested in. In particular, they tend to have a lot of focus on robust failover and recovery. They want to make sure that the system's going to stay up. It's not going to go down. If it does go down, it's going to recover quickly and effectively. Progress is absolutely great at this. Progress, you walk up to a Progress database server, you pull the plug out of it, you got nothing to worry about. Always works. You've got open edge replication, you've got after imaging, you've got great features to support your Progress database. Unfortunately, not all small partners are very familiar with these features, and they don't always do things like enable after imaging. Talk about that a little later too. Security. Big companies are really into security, right? Yeah, really into security. And you know, they have a lot of requirements, a lot of demands. There's a lot of red tape you gotta go through for every little thing you do. Progress provides a lot of support for that. It's not perfect, but there's a lot. Sensitive information, things like social security numbers, credit card numbers, all that kind of stuff. You can go a long ways towards taking care of those problems with transparent data encryption, TDE feature, which is another 100 and something per user, by the way. Open edge auditing. This allows you to keep track of who changed what when, which is really important in a big company kind of a situation. Got to be careful with open edge auditing. Unfortunately, there are some small partners whose approach to open edge auditing is, yeah, that's a great feature. We'll turn it on. We'll audit everything. No, you don't want to audit everything. You really don't. You want to audit the important stuff. And you need to know what the important stuff is. So as a partner, you're supposed to know your application well enough to know that. Big companies, source code. They often want your source code or have it escrowed somewhere, or they basically need to be sure that if you go out of business, they're not gonna go out of business. That there's a path forward if something happens there. So it's good to have an answer for that. And then there's the whole IT empires and counterproductive corporate policy kinds of stuff. Things like whole departments that are dedicated to the concept of, if you're not happy, I'm not happy. So you run into a lot of that at big companies. And if you're a small company that's really used to doing things your own way and being very dynamic, the first time you run into a really big company, it's going to be a really frustrating situation. And help is available in the expo. We have lots of people downstairs who can help you out with this stuff. If you don't know as much as you'd like to know about robust failover and recovery, there are three or four vendors down there that would be happy to help you out with that. If you don't know as much security stuff as you'd like to know, there's a couple of guys down there that are really, really good at security, and so on and so forth. So we've got a great ecosystem. We've got lots of people who can help you out in these areas. If you need some help, talk to me afterwards. And it won't just be me that I recommend either. Okay, helping the expo. Okay, so one of the other things that happens, this happens a lot in big companies, but it's not exclusive to big companies, so I kind of broke it out. A lot of times you have snobs, people who, oh, that's not Microsoft, it can't be any good, you know? Or, oh, the only database worth deploying is Oracle. That kind of thing, or the SQL Server people. You know, everything's got to be the whole Microsoft stack or there's something wrong with it, because only Microsoft knows how to create software that never needs to be rebooted, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Sorry, I forgot who was in the audience. So one of the things that I found, particularly when it comes to the database, it's very helpful for the technical people who have never heard of Progress, is to just tell them, think of it like it's Oracle. Dimitri here has a whole session about this later on this week. And I know that's not exactly true, but it gets you a long ways towards where you need to go. A lot of the concepts in the Progress database map very well to Oracle. They don't always use the same name. You know, we've got the BI file and the AI file instead of the undo log and the redo log. Did I get that backwards? Okay. the point is that the concepts are very, very similar. The vocabulary is a little bit different sometimes, but if you're talking about these things at an architectural level, trying to understand the resources that Progress needs in order to support the application, if you can put it in Oracle terms, you can take care of a lot of issues right up front and not have to deal with them. So if you need more of that, Dimitri's got this nice little talk Tuesday at 1 p.m. Technical resources. So you get past all the big company things and the snobs and whatnot, and now there's the whole, wow, I got all this business, I got to implement it, but I can't find any people. Well, congratulations, you're a Puck Challenge Americas. You are already halfway there. You can also go to Exchange, local Puck meetings. There are a lot of online forums and places where you can go to introduce yourself to people, to meet people, to find out who the good people are. There's a Puck Challenge over in Europe, which is a great place to go because they have like three times as many people as we do. And it's not actually all that much more expensive to get to Europe than it is to get here. Plus, you get to have a little bit of fun touring Dusseldorf this year. Okay. After you're done with Dusseldorf, go down to Cologne. but these Progress events, the face-to-face events are
Christmas markets. It's a weekend after the Puck Challenge.
Yeah. So if you're, you know, need a little Christmas shopping, it's an opportunity not to be missed. But seriously, the face-to-face meetings, either the Puck Challenges or Exchange or your local Puck meetings, those are really good opportunities to network, to understand who the local resources are, who it is you could bring in, to find out who really knows what they're talking about without having to churn through a whole bunch of resumes. Likewise, the online forums give you a lot of exposure to not just problems and the solutions to those problems, but who the people are who understand how things work and you know, where they are. You can also turn that around. By participating in these forums, you're helping people to understand what kind of a company you are and whether or not they might want to come work with you and engage more in you. So don't just be a lurker. Get out there, get on the forums, help people, ask questions. Don't be afraid to ask a stupid question. None of the questions are stupid. Some of the answers are, but not the questions. If you got a problem, you need help. The other thing about technical resources that I personally find very annoying is that when people say they cannot find Progress resources, what I believe that they really mean is they can't find them at the price they want them. and the price they want them is often unrealistically low. And so, yeah, of course nobody answers their ads because they're not paying diddly squat for the job. And if you do get people who respond to your ads for, the $30 an hour programmer, you should probably run away because that's probably not somebody you really want working on your project, especially if it's an important project. OpenEdge is a small niche with high demand. Supply and demand is just as real with technical resources as it is anywhere else. You have a small supply, you have a high demand. The price is going to be higher. You should insist on quality if you're going to pay a good price. So you need to make sure that you get good people. But if you're finding cheap resources, there's probably a reason why they're cheap, and you probably don't like that reason. One of the great things about OpenEdge is it's very teachable. This is an environment which you can very, very easily train somebody to be effective in. Patricia, how long ago did you first hear about Progress?
About a year and a half.
About a year and a half ago. And how are you doing now?
I'm doing very good.
It's something that you can transition people to from other backgrounds without a lot of trouble. They pick it up pretty quickly, and they can go into even a very complex environment without the barriers that you have with some of the other learning environments that you might have to get into. You can also find staff looking to transition from other technologies. What did you come from? What was your?
I did C sharp and I COBOL actually.
COBOL.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
it's something that you can, if you find a college kid who has the right attitude and a little bit of aptitude, you can really get them off and running very, very quick. Mike, you've got a couple of pretty young guys working in your operation. How'd you come about finding them?
Yes, I out of the wider, your circles from customers or partners, friends.
Uh-huh.
Never went to doing ads and reading resumes.
Right.
I used them all up front or got a very good personal recommendation.
And you have a fairly young staff. You're not one of those places that everybody's over 50.
Everybody's over 50.
Not that there's anything wrong with being over 50. I'm over 50. But we heard this morning that, everybody in this room is over 50. No, we're not. There are a lot of young people in the Progress world. We don't see very many of them, partly because they don't usually get sent to conferences. For one thing, they can't rent cars.
At Casper, we have developers around into 20s, yeah, right from the uni, and they are sometimes funny to work with because you need to explain them new touch features from the other side.
Yes.
So not from the procedural side, so looking at Java, .NET, and scaling a little bit down and tell them that OpenEdge is great technology, and eventually they leave you, and they become very great to OpenEdge.
Right. So it's a very, very teachable environment. There's a lot you can do.
Where do they get taught this?
Well, there's a couple of ways you can go about that. If you have a framework in your application, then that's what you want to teach. You want to teach that framework. You don't want to teach them the raw language, at least not to start. If you're just looking to train up a generic Progress programmer, you can get help. There are people who will do training for you down in the expo. Tom, back here. Mike has all kinds of training to go with the tools that he offers. A lot of people will do custom training. There's web-based training on Progress's website. Getting people involved in the community is a great way to do that. But okay, I'll tell you a story about training. Back when I was a partner. This was a long time ago, so it doesn't necessarily work quite as well today as it did then. But I had a guy, he was out of high school, probably 19, something like that, really wanted to be a programmer. He had no experience, but we ran an ad, and he responded to the ad, and the guy in charge of hiring people came to me and he said, I got this resume. He sounds really enthusiastic, but he has no background. I said, well, okay. I'll talk to him. What's he doing Saturday morning? Because, you know, he really wanted it, or at least that's the way it sounded.
Yeah.
So I had him come in Saturday morning. I interviewed him. Sounded really good. Real go-getter. I had some work orders for some customers that were just kind of sitting on my desk. I had him read one of them and said, think you could do that? And he said, yeah. So I gave it to him, pointed him over at a terminal and logged him in, showed him how to use the editor. It took about 5 minutes or something like that. And how long do you think it'll take? Well, half an hour. So I went and got a cup of coffee and whatnot. Came back a little while later. There was one minor compile error in the code that he wrote. Very minor. Oh, I showed him the manuals too. That was the other thing. One trivial compile error. Fixed that, tested it, shipped it. Turned into one of the best programmers that I ever hired. It was really dead easy. And the training was just very, very simple and straightforward. Now, that was 20 years ago. There's a lot more that you have to do in today's environment, but the fundamentals haven't really changed all that much. Progress is still a very, very easy to adopt technology.
I'm in the process of teaching the Mexicans who are six of them who are new to programming.
Yeah.
Two of them claim progress experience, and neither one of them can write a fact word or function.
Yeah, but
so I mean, and I'm not in Mexico. Okay, I live north of here, and I went down there for a week and gave them a basic intro class. And since then, we've been doing by IM, and twice a week we have an hour and a half talk session on web, basically, and they're picking it up. It's not tough.
So they actually using it then?
Yeah. Yeah, they are. We started this tentatively in December, January. We really started to get into it in March, and they already have code going into production next week. Not this week again, but the one after this.
Mike, here you go.
Well, I've been a couple of times involved in projects where young developers were to be trained after us, so. By the older colleagues or by who else. Twice I had application partners, both in England. They had classical old style Pro School application. They hired young developers, trained them 3 months, and they quit. The developers quit because they said, I'm 25, I'm not going to spend with a 20-year-old looking GUI, procedural code the rest of my life. And that's why the partners starting modernizing the application, they realize Pro is a great technology, but we need to make the way we use it more attractive to younger people. So that they actually start the modernization project for HR reasons, not for technical reasons. I also had other cases where that didn't happen. They hired young people and they stayed, and the work environment was good. Also the money and bank in Luxembourg that comes to my mind, maybe they pay very good. So there are a lot of different factors, but the technology of all match that you're using may be part of the package that makes the workplace attractive to your people.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, some people, they only want to work on, you know, the cool stuff and, you know, whatnot. And that's where I, you know, attitude. I don't like that attitude very much. I don't know if anybody picked that up. but if that is important and it's the kind of environment you got to work in, then you have to pay a lot of attention to keeping things modern and sharp. That's for sure. If that's not important, if you're in a legacy kind of a situation, then you need to be really careful that the people you hire are not going to be people who react badly to that. They got to be people who don't mind that they're working with something that's 20 or 30 years old.
Or it looks that way.
Yeah. So that's part of the magic with the technical resources. I hope. Okay. Scalability. like I said, this is a topic that's near and dear to my heart, particularly. So I told you, I created this application 27 years ago and had a lot of fun selling it and whatnot. And like most partners, the last thing on my mind was scalability. It was all about functionality. It was all about getting it out there to be something that the users would engage in and really like. And I never gave 1 minute of thought to scalability for the first 5 years at least. Because progress just ran. I didn't need to do anything. It just ran. In those days, if you had a 100-user system with a 100-megabyte database, that was big. And progress would just, yeah, okay, that's great. Well, we got a 200-user system with a 200-megabyte database. Things didn't go so well, and all of a sudden I had to start paying attention to scalability. So it's become near and dear to my heart ever since then. And a lot of those mistakes are haunting me even today. So here's a couple of tricks that you can use. If you're not already doing this, these are simple things that everybody should be doing with their database. Use type 2 storage areas. No ands, ifs, or buts. Every bit of data in your database should be in a type 2 storage area. User data. Obviously, the schema area has to be type 1 because, well, because. But everything else should be in a type 2 area. There's no reason to ever use a type 1 area for data, indexes, or logs. At a minimum, you should have a separate area for data, indexes, word indexes, and logs, if you're using word indexes or logs. If you don't have any of these in your database, you don't need to worry about them. But data and indexes need to have storage areas dedicated to them. Very simple. If you just create those four storage areas, put the appropriate objects into them, you are 95% of the way there as far as database design configuration for most of your customers is going to go. If you don't want to spend any time thinking about it, just set the rows per block to 128 and use 8 blocks per cluster. And that'll be good enough for almost everybody. You need to plan to be upgradable. Don't plan to deploy on 11.3 and be there for the next 10 years. Have an upgrade strategy. Don't plan to be on 9.1. Don't plan to be on 9.1c forever. Not that I have anybody in mind, but some partners.
The company I worked for and I was on version 8 for 14 years.
Really? Version 8 was a great release.
The only reason that they upgraded was because the operating system wouldn't support it anymore.
Wow.
There are a couple of vendors out there who are very finicky about what release you must run on. And they have an amazing ability to pick releases that they insist on using that have data smashing bugs in them. 7.3c01, 9.1c, stuff like that. You got to be able to upgrade. You can't tie people to such a specific release. There has to be a path forward because things will happen. Eventually, the hardware and the operating system will go away or won't support it or some incompatibility will come up. You're going to have to move, even if you don't grow. This is a good point. A couple of weeks ago, I got a call from a client out on the West Coast that wanted to know if maybe I could help them out with getting the data out of their 6.3c, something like that, database running on Novell NetWare. Now, it's been running great for 20 years. They've been really happy with it. It does everything they want it to do. There's just this one little detail. The Novell system is going to die. So, luckily, I was able to do that for them. But they couldn't find any of their source code. So now they're going to have to rewrite the application somehow. I can get the data out of it, but they don't know where their source is. So we got the R code. It'll run for a little while, but not for much longer. Another thing, this is for you, Mike. Do not tie your database to Windows servers. I mean, Windows is great, and in a well-run Windows system, I'm not being taped. Windows is fine. A well-run Windows system can handle a pretty good volume. It does happen. I have several customers that I think do a real good job managing their Windows systems, but there's a limit on how big they can get. And if you deploy only on Windows and then you get one of those great big monster customers, you're not going to be able to tell them, oh yeah, Windows 2008 server, just put one of those in and everything will go great. Well, what about my 10,000 users? Windows probably won't support that. You need to have enough flexibility to potentially go somewhere else. Just don't deliberately tie yourself to Windows in a silly way. Another thing about scalable systems, transaction scope. So one of the big things that people who are initially writing applications really like about the Progress database, and it's a great feature, is rolling back transactions and how easy that is to do with the 4GL. But they make the mistake of implementing business logic as a transaction. So they'll have some business process like month-end close, and they'll decide it's all or nothing. So I'm going to make it one great big fat transaction. And that works really good. Makes a great demo. Fabulous demo. You start the transaction, you get the month-end close going, you pull the plug on the server, plug it back in, show, oh, look, everything's back the way it was. Well, that's great until you get that great big gigantic customer again. And they have a month-end closing that involves millions and millions of records. Now your lock table blows up. And the only way to fix it is either to do something that requires an outage, like shutting down and running single user for a couple hours, which big customers don't have a couple of hours, or you have to rewrite the code to break up those transactions into smaller chunks that are restartable. Most of those business processes that get implemented this way are very easy to code as something that you can do in chunks, that you can restart when you at the point where you left off and things like that. It's not a hard thing to do, but if you don't think about it ahead of time, it bites you in the butt at the very wrong moment. Control tables. So a lot of people, they're writing their application and they have this table that has just a couple of records in it. It's a control table of some sort. It has maybe the company ID in it and some critical information. And every time they want to know something, they just read that record. Works great when you don't have very many users, when you're a very small system. Now you deploy it into a multi-thousand user system, and you have millions and millions of reads per second against one record. You need to be able to cache that kind of stuff and to put it into more modern structures, either an object or a temp table or something like that. Query efficiency. Like I was mentioning earlier, back in the day when I designed my application, that was the farthest thing from my mind. I didn't even know that such a concept existed. So some of my queries weren't quite as efficient. as they should have been. And you'll find a lot of that in vendor applications or partner applications that are being they're coming up market. They've never really had to deal with the issues of a big system with a lot of activity, and they don't really need to worry about how efficient those queries are until they get that big customer. And then the big customer comes along, and stuff that at all their other customer sites, it runs fine. It's running 10 minutes, or it's running half an hour, or 3 days. Stuff like that happens. Single-threaded operations and queues. So if you have things that only one user can do, that's a single-threaded operation. You might want to think about, well, how could I break this up at some point later in time to have more than one user do it, or to set up three or four batch runs to do this kind of a process for me? Because the big customer will have a window at night when they can run that kind of stuff, but when they get really big, that window starts stretching into the morning and lunchtime and stuff like that. So architecturally, you need to think about that ahead of time. And again, don't tie your app servers and your batch processes to Windows. And the easiest way to do that is to use ProWin32. That's the easiest way to tie it to Windows. Because people are just used to, oh, it's Windows, I'm going to run Pro Win32, right? You can run the headless progress, the character progress, and if it's a batch program, it basically doesn't matter unless you use some of the .NET stuff. But if you isolate those particular features in the app servers that need them, then at deployment time, if you actually do need to have a Windows app server for those things, you can keep them on Windows, but the rest of it can go somewhere else. It's just a simple little mistake. Yes, Mike?
The best way to test it is right from the beginning when you're developing a Linux app server to make sure, and a compile server to make sure you don't have backslashes in your source code and things like that. I'm a Windows fan, we use Linux for that purpose, just to make sure that, that we don't accidentally make the code which doesn't compile if somebody broadcast numbers to it.
Yeah.
Easy to set up, you just need to do it. It takes an afternoon and then you'll be happy for the rest of your life.
Bingo. Happy for the rest of your life. I like that part. We're getting there. Okay. Another mistake that partners will make on the scalability front, because they don't have a lot of experience with this, and they haven't, they probably haven't built up this experience, it's the first time they're doing a big system, is that they'll think that bigger is better. So the big company will come to them and say, oh, I got this monster HP Superdome, it can run anything. Or, I probably shouldn't use HP, should I? Some great big monster piece of hardware. So of course, all my problems are gonna go away because I've got this monster piece of hardware, right? Wrong. Sometimes the monster hardware actually makes it worse. In particular, this is a problem, I'll skip ahead. So there's this thing called NUMA, which is how lots and lots of CPUs get put into a big frame. But by spreading stuff out all over the place, you end up with the system having to do a lot more work to coordinate keeping it all together. It can be way better to keep it in a smaller package where things are closer together, where it doesn't take as much time to get things done. This can happen with the servers. SANs are terrible. Big companies love them because it means that the storage group only has to have a couple of storage engineers and they don't have to work weekends anymore, and that's, you know, it's wonderful. Storage engineers aren't working weekends, I don't have to hire as many of them, they're great. But SANs are never the DBA's friend. SANs are not there to make the DBA's life easier, they're there to make the storage administrator's life easier. And because they're shared, that means that you pay the penalty for everything else that's going up on those SANs. Now, you know, like RAID 5, it's ugly, it's awful, it's horrible, nobody should ever run it, but everybody does, and you don't really have a choice about it. So you have to have a strategy for mitigating that. You have to make sure that your application is efficient, that your queries are good, that you've tuned as best you can to avoid I/O, because you're gonna get stuck with these things in the big companies. In the little companies, you may very well be able to say, no, don't get that. Just have an internal disk, SSD, it'll handle it, don't worry. And the little company will do that. But the big company has corporate standards and they got groups out there that are putting all these things together, and you will never change their mind, no matter how bad it is. The users will be in the hallways with their pitchforks and their torches, and the big company storage administrators will say, no, that's our standard. So sharing is not always caring. Any kind of thin provisioning, virtualization, SANs, they all come with dangers. They're not a free ticket to better performance. So again, if you need help with that kind of stuff, the ecosystem is full of people who can help you. They're all down in the expo, the good ones. And there's a few partner worst practices that I wanted to just kind of bring up. Some things that I've run into a few times. One is this notion that one size fits all. They have one deployment, they give it to everybody, and you can't step outside of that. That's a really bad idea. You have to maintain a little bit of flexibility. If you don't, when you run into the unusual customer, the big customer, or the customer that started out small and becomes enormously successful, that one size fits all is not gonna work. We talked about this a little bit earlier, the idea that a customer has to use a particular release of progress, that I'm only certified on 9.1c, and anything else, I won't support you. You shouldn't do that. You know, we won't support customers if you modify the storage areas, you upgrade progress, you change any startup parameters, you use any OS other than Windows version X.Y, service pack Z, or if you talk to anybody who is not part of the partner organization. Oh, sorry, you're out of support. These are horrible things, and partners should not do them. You don't want to be the partner who does this because you'll be ridiculed in my presentation. And then one of the things that is one of the worst things that partners do beyond this is they fail to implement after imaging. After imaging is absolutely critical to data integrity. 20 years ago, you could imagine a world where somebody could run all day and have their system fail at the end of the day, go up in flames or whatever, and you would be able to go back to paper and rekey everything that happened. How long has it been since that was a reality, since you could really count on doing a thing like that? It's been a long time. So without after imaging, your recovery point is the last good backup that you can get. So that's at least a day old for most people. And remember, I said the last good backup. So if your backups are in the closet that the server went up in flames in, that last good backup might not exist. Or it might be the one that you took home for Christmas or something like that. So you really need to have after imaging, and you really need to get the after image logs off of that server and into a secure location on a very regular basis. I think 15 minutes is kind of the minimum. And after imaging is very easy to set up. There are whole presentations on it. I don't know if anybody's doing one this year. I don't remember one. But it's easy to set up, it's easy to configure. It should be a default part of every partner's deployment, is to just have after imaging set up, configured, and running to protect your customers' data. We're at the end. Any questions? None? Zero? Okay. Thank you. We're 3 minutes early.